it's time to have a chat with another real person, Tom Santee, regarding his retirement planning in this, the 91st episode of the Retirement Planning Education Podcast.
Welcome to the Retirement Planning Education Podcast, where you can learn all about IRAs and Roth IRAs, employer retirement plans, taxes, Social Security, Medicare, portfolio withdrawal strategies, annuities, estate planning, and much more. And now here's your host, Andy Panko.
Thank you, everyone, for joining. We have another great real person episode today. Today's special guest is Tom Santee. Hello, Tom.
Hi, Andy. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for being on. Before I get into it, though, Tom, I want to tell you something. I've been prescribed anti-gloating cream. I can't wait to rub it in.
That's good.
Thanks.
That's good. I like that one.
We got one more. Yeah, just in case you didn't like that one. A storm blew away 25% of my roof last night. Oof.
Oh, the first one better.
I have to see that in writing. Yeah. OOF. Yeah. 25% is gone. Anyway. All right. So, Tom, thank you for joining. Looking forward to this for a while. Always a good time to hear other real people, what they do, questions they have, concerns they have, how they've been approaching their own retirement. So I already jumped ahead a little bit and mentioned your name is Tom Santee. Tom, how did you find out about this podcast?
I think from your Facebook group, Andy. I've been pretty active in that group, so I think it got mentioned in there. Like, hey, I need to check that out.
Hopefully you haven't been let down.
I have not. They've been great.
Okay, cool. Thank you. What state do you live in?
I currently live in Florida.
Okay. And how old are you, for the record?
I am 60 years old. Be 61 in March.
Okay. Be almost birthday.
Thank you.
Do you have a significant other?
I do not. I am divorced, got divorced in my 50s, so currently single.
Any, tell me it's none of my business, but any other planning or financial considerations that you still have now you need to factor in regarding the divorce in your ex or no?
Yeah, spousal support and how retirement might impact that is a huge issue.
Okay.
And I've not been able to get a very clear answer from the people I've talked to. So that's on the list to work out as I get closer to retirement. Other than that, we pretty much split all the assets and we still share some expenses for the kids, but nothing too major other than the spousal support.
Okay. And I didn't mean to pry. I just think this will be relevant and
yes,
relatable question for many people listening. So, okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
And what is your retirement status at this point or lack thereof?
Yeah, I am currently working part-time. So I had been working full-time as a chief operating officer, consulting chief operating officer for a couple of companies. I think it was last May I decided to step back. I actually resigned, but told them I would stay on in a lesser role to just do consulting and work on some projects. So I've been doing that. I took about an 8-week sabbatical, and then I went back toward the end of last August. It's been great. I feel like I'm doing valuable work. I'm supposed to work about 20 hours a week. I like to work, so I've been working a little more. I feel like I'm adding value. I can focus more on a couple projects, things I really want to get done. The decrease in stress has been tremendous. So I think it's one of the best things I've ever done.
Great. And do you have any sort of formal or informal arrangement with your employer about winding down, transitioning, or is it just kind of, you know, day by day, month by month, you and them decide when this no longer makes sense?
Yeah, we'll decide when this no longer makes sense. They've been really good to me and said, I think I had a lot of value to their organization. I have a lot of history. And so right now it's a win-win, but I am cognizant that at some point that could change.
Right. And are able to, you don't need to say particular companies, but are you able to share what type of work you do, what type of industry?
Yeah, I'm currently, these two companies are in the health insurance space. So one is more a reinsurer in that space, and then the other one does healthcare plan design, administration, compliance consulting. Okay. So pretty niche market, but it's been fun.
Yeah, great. And do you have, we already sort of touched on this, how you're kind of transitioning to retirement, but do you have any sort of target or date or firm impetus for when you want to truly stop working or, you know, whatever retirement means to you?
Yeah, I wish I could say I have a definitive yes. You know, I think some of the posts in your Facebook group have been about the one more year mentality and the one more dollar mentality. So I'm struggling a little bit with that. We'll probably get into it later, but there's also a little fear. I mean, I liked working part-time. But to not be working at all and have all that time to fill has, for somebody that's kind of been a workaholic, it's a little concerning for me. So I'm using this transition period to kind of work that out a little better and figure out what retirement might look like.
I think that's great. The transition, the glide path down idea. Many people don't realize this until retirement is upon them, you know, traditional retirement where they're running full steam, working 40, 50 hours a week for 40 years, whatever, and then stop cold turkey, whether it's choosing or not, stop cold turkey. And for better or worse, a lot of people have their identity and their fulfillment and sort of sense of being tied up in their job, especially if you have kids and the kids are now grown and out of the house, like your work is what you do. And when that stops, that can be a real shock to the system and not in a pleasant way for many people. So I think it's good that you're sort of touching, you know, dipping your toe in the water to sort of get a feel for it, right? And help you further the transition to the eventual final retirement, whatever that looks like. So,
yeah, and I did take a couple of sabbaticals, I guess, during my career. They weren't paid or in the traditional sort of education system sabbaticals, but, you know, lost some jobs. Got laid off a couple times, and sometimes between those, I took a little extra time off, and then taking the sabbatical last summer. It was helpful. I really enjoyed the time off last summer, but it also brought home there are a lot of hours in the day. So yeah, I'm glad I've been able to do this glide path, and I did not want to go. I was probably working 60 hours a week, so I really didn't want to go from working 60 hours a week, 7 days a week, to working nothing. As you said, I think that cold turkey would have been really hard to adjust to.
Right. Pretty general, vague question, but what are your financial goals and priorities for retirement? And then same question around non-financial goals for retirement.
Yeah, I'd say on the financial goals side, I don't want to run out of money.
That's a good one.
Sorry if that's kind of a very high-level answer, but that would be a major financial goal. I'd like to be able to continue to live my current lifestyle. I've always largely lived below my means, but I've done fairly well in my career. So right now I have a, I wouldn't say extravagant lifestyle by any means, but one that works pretty well for me. And I'd like to be able to continue to do the things I enjoy doing and have the money to do that. And then I'm not sure this is a goal, is maybe an outcome, but I would like to leave a legacy to my kids. I know it's a little controversial as I read through the Facebook group. People have very different, you know, ideas on this, but if I could leave my kids a legacy so they wouldn't have to work as hard as I did, maybe they could pursue career interests regardless of the compensation of those fields. I'd be pretty proud to have that on my tombstone as, you know, made my kids' lives easier or something along that way. So that would be another sort of goal I'd like to have, but I'm not going to do it at the expense of my retirement. So
right.
Not like I'm not going to retire or travel or spend the money. You know, I want to enjoy my retirement. I've worked very hard for it. But if there was a nice sum left for them, I would be very happy about that.
Yeah. And it's interesting you said controversial. And I agree it is. I don't think it should be. This is one of those things where it's so deeply personal. The right answer for you isn't necessarily the right answer for someone else. And someone shouldn't tell you, or allude to you that you wanting to leave money for your children is improper or, you know, not the best way to go about it. Right. It's right. You. So
go ahead.
I was just going to say, I just finished reading a book called Die with Zero. I don't know if you've heard of it or.
I've heard of it. Yes. I haven't read it, but I've heard of it.
Fascinating read. And he talks about the leaving money to kids or churches or whomever. And the view is you ideally want to die with zero, hence the name of the book. The fine balancing act is to not hit zero before you die and not die with, you know, $2 million. If you do want to leave a legacy to kids, to religious organizations, to whomever, do it during life when they can use it, when they can get benefit and enjoyment out of it, instead of them having to wait until you're, you know, out of this planet or off this planet. Now, I agree in concept. That sounds amazing, but it's hard. Like, how do you dial in exactly how much you can give away during life and not hit zero before you pass? So, but it was really good food for thought. I would highly recommend everyone read it. It's hard to implement in practice. And he alluded to that in the book, but it was a really insightful read.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. I've heard a lot of people post in your group about it. But I don't know. I mean, leaving $2 million to your kids doesn't sound so bad to me. So
yeah, no, it's not.
Especially if you enjoyed your retirement.
That's exactly it, right? If you skimp and you shortchange yourself
in
retirement because you know, you don't live the fullest retirement you want or could have. That's the issue he points out. Now, to be fair, he didn't say how much money he has in the book, but he made it pretty clear he's rather wealthy. So kind of easier said than done for someone that objectively has more money than they're going to be able to spend. It was at least my interpretation of how he described himself. So, you know, the diet zero kind of is a little easier to get to in his case than it is for many people. But nonetheless, you know, good food for thought.
The other thing is a little bit of a tangent to this, but after I moved from Chicago area to Illinois in 2022, so I wanted to update I put all my assets in a trust just to make the estate administration easier for my heirs. So I met with an estate planning attorney down here to redo the documents. And my kids are in their 20s. And they were pushing me pretty hard about, why do you want to leave all this to your kids right now? Don't you want to spread it out? And I was like, no, I don't. I mean, to your earlier point, each makes their own decision there, but I don't want to control it from the grave. I trust my kids. And if it would make a meaningful difference in their life if I unfortunately died earlier, I'd much rather they just have it. And if they blow it all, that was their choice. Right. So,
yeah.
Respect others feel differently.
Right. Okay. So, and moving on to some general retirement planning questions. When did you start getting serious about planning for your retirement? And we have an interesting angle with you and your sort of extracurricular in the CFP world, which we can touch on. But so when did you really start getting serious about retirement and planning?
I started my career in the employee benefits business for a consulting firm called Hewitt Associates. So this was back in 1985. I joined their defined contribution or 401k group. So, you know, very early, first job out of college, I was into retirement plans. Now, we administered plans. We didn't do financial advising and all. But they had an annual profit sharing contribution that went into retirement plan. So from a very, you know, age 21 or 22, I was starting to save for retirement, which was helpful. Then as I learned more about 401ks and they offered it as employee benefit beyond the profit sharing, I was putting some of my paycheck into retirement at that point. I think throughout most of my life, both my ex and I were good with money. We lived pretty frugally below our means. So we always had a mentality of, you know, let's just try to save a lot of money, kind of just accumulate a big bucket for later in life, or hopefully for later in life. So all of that was just kind of over the course of my career. And as I started to do better at work, then I would max out the 401k contributions. In all, most years I couldn't do IRAs, or couldn't do the tax deductible IRAs. So I normally didn't do the non-deductible ones. And then I can't remember if it was 22 or 23, I did hire a CFP to advise me on some financial planning related to retirement. So she ran cash flow projections, you know, asset allocation recommendations, Monte Carlo analysis. And so that's when I felt like I really got the most serious about it. I'd been doing the accumulation phase kind of on autopilot and just wanted to get some advice from her on, now that I'm thinking about retirement and it's getting closer, you know, what does it look like? What might I be able to do?
Right. And speaking of CFP, I kind of let the cat out of the bag a little bit, but can you discuss, I know you pursued CFP sort of?
Yes, sure. So I did become a CFP back in, I think, 1993. I got in right before, it was like the day before you had to take the comprehensive test if you didn't register. So yeah. I did that, did it for 2 years, passed the 6 tests at the time and became a CFP, I guess, in 94, early 95, something like that. So I've kept my license current, so I still am technically a CFP, but I have never, ever used it professionally. I've never been in that industry. I've never had clients. I did a lot of work with my mom and helped her a lot, but it's never been a professional pursuit of mine, but a great source of financial information. I learned a lot. I think it helped me personally, helped me advise some family members. Right. I don't know how many CFPs are out there that don't practice, but I'm glad I did it. And I like doing the continuing ed to keep my license current and just learn more about what's going on currently.
That's what I was going to ask. I feel like that's something I should know, but the continuing education, is it 30 hours every 2 years? You have to do that same amount, even though you're not practicing?
I have to do the same amount as you. Yep.
Okay. Which is good. I mean, it keeps you fresh. So, all right. What resources do you or did you find most helpful in learning about retirement planning? Obviously, starting with the CFP when you did, it was a good primer. But, you know, along the way, where did you go for information and knowledge?
Yeah, I think back in the pre-internet era, it was a lot of the print magazines. There was Money Magazine. I think it was called Smart Money. It wasn't around quite as long. It was a collaboration with the Wall Street Journal and somebody else, Kiplinger, and then the old print newspaper thing of the past for the most part. But they'd have articles and real estate sections, financial business sections that I always really enjoyed. So that was, you know, historically a good source for me. You know, I'd say the CFP stuff was helpful, but I don't know your experience with mine is it was pretty academic. And even going through it, I was like, no, the real world doesn't work this way. Right, I mean, right. I appreciate the information, but it seemed like it was almost too textbooky and not as real world practical as I would have liked. So I think some of those sources I mentioned were, you know, kind of supplement that when Money Magazine used to profile individuals and have a couple CFPs to give them advice. And I always found that really, really helpful. There were some books that I read that I found were helpful. One, I don't know if you've heard of it. It was called Your Money Ratios by Charles Farrell. And I thought it was a great book. It didn't get much attention. The premise of his book is he had benchmarks of like asset accumulations and percent of income you should be saving by age. So one of the things I found challenging with financial planning is you're doing all this stuff, but you don't have a whole lot to benchmark it against. Right, I'm putting the max in the 401k, and I'm getting the employer match, and you know all. But what does that all mean? Do I know I'm doing okay or not? So you could certainly quibble with some of his benchmarks if you wanted, but I just thought it really gave you some good goals to shoot for and things to balance where you're at against some of his recommendations. So I would highly recommend that book. It's still in print. I like The Millionaire Next Door. I think that was just interesting that, you know, your typical millionaire is wearing blue jeans, driving a pickup truck, and probably right. has the 3-bedroom ranch house in the burbs. You know, that was interesting. And I enjoyed that. I read A Random Walk Down Wall Street because everybody tells you to read it. Kind of mixed on that one. I don't know that it was that practical, but I felt like you sort of had to read it because everybody right. was telling you to.
A little technical, a little heavy, a little focused just on investments, but
yeah. The next couple books are not really on financial planning, but I just found them helpful to maybe ways to think about financial planning and decision-making. One was called The Numeracy, and the author's premise was that numeracy is the mathematical equivalent of illiteracy. And his point was a lot of us really struggle with statistics, logic, probability, math, and then he'd have examples of maybe how marketing firms use that, you know, general sense of numeracy to persuade you to buy stuff or think about things incorrectly. It was a little dense, but I really liked it and would recommend it as well. And then there was a book written in 1954 called How to Lie with Statistics. I think it's still available in paperback. The cultural references to the 50s were hilarious, but it was on a similar theme, right? Of just be careful with statistics. They don't always mean what you think they mean. There's different ways to present, you know, maybe factually correct, but very misleading information with statistics.
Right.
So I enjoyed that. I'm currently reading a book called Thinking in Bets. It was a former professional poker player. She's now consulting with Fortune 500 companies. I'm only about a quarter of the way through it, but she had this really fascinating section on separating the decision making from the decision outcome. Right. And I thought that's really relevant to financial planning. I mean, as a pro poker player, right? You're going to have great hands and do everything right, and your opponent's going to have a better hand. Doesn't mean you made bad decisions. You were looking at the information you had and all. So I really like that concept. And when you think of financial planning, you know, I just reallocated and the market went down. I shouldn't have. Well, no, you should have, right?
Exactly.
You have a reallocation strategy. What the market did is irrelevant to whether you made a good decision there or not. So I really like that concept in her book. And I'm looking forward to getting through it more.
Yeah.
I listened to a couple of radio shows through the years. Bob Brinker, he was on in Chicago. I don't know if he was national, but I love Bob's voice. He was very down to earth. And I think his name was Chris Farrell, not the Charles Farrell that wrote the book I mentioned, but Chris had an NPR program, Money Planet or something that I always found very interesting.
Okay.
So sorry, that's kind of a long-winded answer to your question.
Oh, no, that's great. I'll share links or references to these in the notes to this episode for people that want to check them out. One thing about the poker player, as you were saying this reminded me of a comment I heard, and it might be from that book. If it's not, it should be. But this statement, or it goes something along the lines of, don't mistake a bad outcome for a bad decision.
Yes.
And that's so relevant in planning and investing. So for example, we all know, I think everyone knows, it's dangerous to have all of your investments in one single stock, for example. A good decision would be that should be diversified into something that's not all your eggs in one basket. So that's a good decision. But a bad outcome could be, you know, had you invested all your money in, let's say, Tesla 20 years ago, you would have done substantially better financially than if you invested in the tried and true diversified stock index fund, whatever. That's a bad outcome comparatively. It doesn't mean it was a bad decision to diversify and get out of all Tesla 20 years ago. It just means the outcome wasn't as good as it should have been.
Right.
So don't confuse bad outcome for a bad decision. You know, everyone keep that in mind. All right, great. How would you rate your knowledge of retirement-related financial investing, tax issues, et cetera?
I mean, overall, I think it's pretty good, but then I'll read something in your Facebook group or an article and get pretty humbled. So I think it's a complex, I mean, there's a lot in this field. There's a lot between the investments, the taxes, insurance, et cetera. So overall, yeah, I think I have it down pretty good, but I'm always willing to learn more and have a deep appreciation for how complicated it is. Just give you one example. I had a relative that did very well over his career. He retired early to the point you just made about stock. Probably 90% of his net worth was in his company's stock. Now, been one of the best performing stocks over the last 30 years. So lots of good stuff. He had a lot of options when he exercised his options because they were expiring. He just converted into shares of the company. So now he's looking at, hey, I'm retiring. I have different liquidity needs. Anything I sell, I have a huge capital gains issue because the stock's gone through the roof. Well, one of the big financial houses had an exchange fund where they were willing to accept shares in kind from people like my relative. And then they would take those shares into their fund. So you had executives from lots of different companies that were doing it. So you got a diversified portfolio, but you didn't have to sell the stock. There was no capital gain issue. Now, you were locking up your money for 7 years. There were fees and all. But I wasn't aware of that till he had this issue and met this planner. And I was like, wow, that's a great solution for people that have that issue. I'd never heard of it. I didn't think it was legal at first. Was like, how do you do that without recognizing the tax implication? But it was all legit, and it's worked out very well for him.
Yeah, great. Yeah, I've heard about those. I've never saw someone use one in practice, but yeah, you're basically converting or transferring into a private pooled investment fund where you diversify your exposure a little bit without having to recognize the tax impact of buying. Yeah,
that was great for him. You know, I think just a couple other things on the knowledge. I've come to accept there's not always right answers.
Right.
Okay, we'll talk a little later about Social Security claiming, but to me, that's really a mystery and a really tough one, right? So all sorts of analysis, but hard to know what to do there. I've struggled a little bit with ACA subsidies versus Roth conversions if you retire early. And I asked a few people that I read their articles if they had any analysis of it. They didn't. I'd also say, though, I've tried sometimes not to get too far into the weeds. I mean, like chasing 5 basis points on a $10,000 CD yield seems like, you know, that's probably not worth the time or effort. Or doing us, you know, should I convert $1,000 or $2,000 more on my Roth? I don't know. I think you can drive yourself crazy sometimes at those fringes.
Yeah, I fully agree that there's a lot of over-optimization that can come into play, especially around tax-related tax planning matters. Like, to your point, if I convert $10,000 or $12,000 now, which one's better for me? It doesn't matter. Over the course of your next 30 years, it doesn't matter, right?
Right.
You know, converting 10 versus 100 could move the needle long-term, but a couple thousand bucks, like, don't sweat it. All right. I just want to step back. I realized in my comment before, I said if someone invested in Tesla 20 years ago, as an example, it would do well. I just realized Tesla probably wasn't around 20 years ago. So in case someone catches it and like, hey, silly, that can't be possible. So replace that with Microsoft, let's say, whatever.
Right.
Point is some stock that did really well over the last 20, 30 years.
Two other just quick quotes may related to that. I had a manager once, even though we weren't in the financial planning business, but she said to me, I thought it was really interesting. She said, you know, Tom, generally concentration builds wealth and diversification protects wealth. You know, look at Enron, you know, not always true, but right. I thought it was an interesting sort of statement, and probably in a lot of cases true to your point with the Microsoft or Tesla and all. And then I forget, it was a hedge fund manager, I think, but he said, never confuse brilliance for a bull market. And I also like that one.
Yeah. I'd love to know who said that. And I'd like to shake his or her hand, because that's so true. So many people in the investment world, whether they fully believe this or they're just toeing the line because it's their livelihood, think they can beat the market or attribute good outcomes to skill as opposed to the market went up or happenstance or, you know, whatever. Many times, anecdotally, funds that do well, managers that do well with investments will attribute doing well to skill. When things don't do well, they'll attribute it to circumstances outside their control. Like, I couldn't have saw that coming or whatever. Yeah. You don't say that when things happen to go your way, but you say it when they don't. So there definitely needs to be much more humility within the industry. So it warms my heart to hear you make that quote. Okay. Another sort of general vaguey question, but regarding financial and non-financial aspects of retirement planning, what do you wish you would have known or done differently when you were younger?
You know, I don't know if it would have worked just based on what options were available and then later in life, my tax brackets, but I wish I had more money in Roths. So it's kind of an outcome. I don't know if practically I could have gotten there. Right. But now as I enter retirement, I don't have that much in Roths. I do have a decent amount in a brokerage account, but even then I'll have capital gains compared to the Roths. So if I had a complete do-over and knew where I was going to end up at this age, I would have put a lot more money in Roths. That I think that would have helped. Had I known I was going to get divorced in my 50s, I probably would have done a few things differently, but that's probably a topic for another podcast. It's a complicated issue overall. I'd say overall, I try not to do a lot of hindsight. I certainly want to learn from my mistakes. Like many years ago, I bought some limited partnerships when they were all the rage. It was one of the dumbest things I ever did. But for the most part, you know, I try not to do hindsight investing. You know, I should have sold out at that peak and I should have then reinvested at that bottom. You know, you drive yourself nuts with that and you never could have made those calls in the moment.
Exactly.
So I pretty much just try to move forward.
Okay. There's always going to be woulda, coulda, shouldas that you're going to look back and kick yourself on. But like you said, learn from them. If nothing else, you get better insight and knowledge about what to do or not do going forward. But I don't think there's anyone that can look back and honestly say to themselves, like, everything I did in life, financial, non-financial, whatever, 100% was the way I wanted to do it. And I wouldn't have done anything differently, right? Like hindsight's always 20/20. You're always going to find things that you wish you would have done differently, but so be it.
And you've probably read it too, Andy, but occasionally read about these guys that called market crashes, and part of the analysis was that they had a 50-50 chance of being right.
You know,
maybe wasn't that great skill. I'm sure some had very good analytical capabilities there, but you know, if you go back to the stats, well, you might be, you know, just half and half to begin with. So,
There's a joke / comment that economists have gotten 12 out of the last 3 recessions right. they've called 12 out, something like that. You get the point, but
yes, yeah, that's good.
A broken clock is right twice a day, so. Someone's out there beating the drum about the bear market and the end is near. They're going to be right eventually. You know, maybe it'll be years, but they will be right eventually. That's when they get their claim to fame. Like, oh, look at this. I called it. Like, you did, but you didn't, right? You've been saying it wrong for how long now? So anyway.
I also think depending on your age, some of that stuff doesn't really matter. I mean, to me, if you're in your 30s, saving for retirement, and maybe you're mostly in equities and the market crashes, I don't know that that's really a significant event for you. I get it has a psychological impact, sure. But I wrote out most of the crashes over my career and just stayed invested. And it's like, I don't need the money till I'm in my 60s. I'm in my 40s. So I'm sure it'll come back up eventually.
Same. Yeah. It's arguably good. It's an opportunity. If, especially, you know, when the market drops a lot, if you're young, you have time on your side for it to rebound. And if you're in a position where you have more money, where you can increase your contributions, you're now buying at a discount. So like like, was it Warren Buffett, you know, be fearful when people are greedy and greedy when people are fearful. it's the latter, right? When everyone's selling because they're scared because the market dropped 30%, that's when you want to pile in, assuming you have time on your side again. Like, you know, if you're 85, it's probably not good advice. But if you're 30 and you're not touching this money for 30 years, then get in.
Yep.
Just quick personal story. So I started working in graduated college in 2000, started working in 2000. So right at the beginning of the tech bust. So I started my 401k, you know, as soon as I was able to at my first job out of college at whatever I was, 22 years old, I guess. Thought I was on the right track. And then, you know, 3 years of bad, and I was all in stock at the time because I knew I was young and whatever, you know, be pure stock exposure. And then 3 bad years of stock return. So that stung. But then it came back. And then financial crisis happened in 07, 08, 09. To add insult to injury, our first child was born October 2007. And as soon as she had her social security number, I opened a 529 for her and put in, it was like $10,000. I don't remember. I was like, yeah, I'm really getting a good start on her college education. And then the crash happened and that lost like 60%. And I was like, yeah, I give up. Like I got disheartened. I didn't follow my own advice now. Like, no, pile more in. I was just like, this doesn't feel good. But you know, it recovered and things came back and just look where we are now relative to then. And not saying the market always is going to go up, but historically that's been the case. And I'm glad I stayed in and I'm glad I kept contributing to my 401k, to my 529s, my brokerage account. And it worked out. But, you know, it stung. And even though I was whatever, I was like 30 at the time, I guess my daughter was born. I was like, really? I just lost 60% of this money I put in. I thought I had a good start. It just kicked the legs out from under me, but it worked out, thankfully. Okay. So do you work with an advisor? If so, what makes it worth it to you? Now, I know you said you did. You did at least a one-time plan. Can you elaborate a little more? Have you worked with someone in the past or is it just this one-time thing recently?
I have worked with them in the past as well as this one-time thing. I kind of have a lot to say on this topic, so bear with me. Yeah, but I have on a periodic basis. I never have on a recurring basis. I've never used the AUM model with anybody, so I've always been a do-it-yourself friend. That side, I've interviewed a lot of them over the years, and you know, every few years I wanted to get a second opinion or just go out and ask around. I kind of like to write a book, maybe collaborate with somebody called In Search of a Financial Planner, because it's really it was a fascinating experience. Their different pitches and different ways they tried to explain their value.
I think stop right there for a moment. That's a fantastic idea. And I guarantee lots of people listening are like, yes, please do that. Because you're not alone in the quagmire of trying to search through and make sense of all these people that put themselves out there to be financial professionals or advisors. Hopefully you run with this, and I'll try to hold you to it, but that's a fantastic idea. I'd like to see you actually carry through if possible and do that book.
Well, if any of your listeners want to collaborate, I would love a partner in the endeavor.
Awesome. So anyone listening, reach out to me if you're serious about maybe doing this with Tom and I'll get you in touch.
So part of my experience with all this has been, I think advisors have a hard time justifying their fees for the value they add. I have no issue with people getting paid for their work. I've worked with attorneys and accountants and others throughout my life. And I feel, you know, people deserve to earn a living and deserve to be paid what it's worth. But I think the AUM model, the year after year of that same fee, I could see maybe year one as the advisor, you're doing a lot of work, you're getting to know them, you're getting everything structured. But after that, it seems like, I mean, a really lucrative model for the advisor, not such a great model for the consumer. And I ask every planner I interview, I said, how do you add value for the fees I pay you? And a lot cannot give me a coherent answer. One guy said, you know, I prevent you from making mistakes, which in some ways I thought was a somewhat good answer, if you know you really can. I've not been prone to, like, I don't panic sell and stuff. So I get where that might be really valuable for a lot of people. I'm not sure that was as valuable for me. But I think advisors really need to spend more time thinking about how do they justify the fee for what they're doing, and how do you justify it as an annuity or recurring annual fee, not buying an annuity, but the annuity of the fee structure. So all the CFPs I've used, it's been on an hourly or project basis. And so I've liked that. I'm there, I'm paying for what I get. And, you know, they charge $300-$400 an hour, but I feel like I'm getting really good information out of it. That's worth it to me. This might be a little controversial, but I really don't feel like most people need a financial advisor to manage their money. The pure investment side of it, a little bit like we talked about earlier. I think you might need one initially to help you with asset allocation. Where do you want to locate your assets for tax efficiency? You know, maybe bond funds and qualified retirement accounts if you're not getting a lot of taxable income you don't need. And maybe a rebalancing strategy as well. But that feels like one-time work to me, very valuable one-time work. Myself, since about 2006 or seven, I've been entirely in index funds, unless I had an employer retirement plan where they didn't offer it. But I just went the index route. I found it simpler and easier to manage. So when people like in the Facebook group say, I want an FA or a CFP or something, I'm always thinking, what do you want them for? So I would encourage anybody that's going to use an advisor, have a really good idea of what you want out of that advisor before you start interviewing and talking to them. Just a little bit of a tangent, but I've been thinking a lot about this concept of accepting the return of your asset allocation. So back to just how the advisor helps you. This guy I talked about that helped my relative with his exchange fund, I talked to him about advising me. And one of the things he was asking me, he was the same guy that said, I keep you from making mistakes. And this might have been in 22 when the market was pretty bad. Things had gone down. And he said, you know, I keep you from panic selling. I keep you from making those mistakes. How has your portfolio done over the last year? And what do you think about it? And I said, well, it's done terrible because the market's done terrible. I said, I picked my asset allocation. I picked the index funds I wanted to be in. So I pretty much have to accept the return. I mean, it's just a result of what I did. He was like, wow, you're kind of weird. Nobody ever tells me that. But I'm like, what should I expect? I mean, if I'm 80% in equities and, you know, the market's down 20%, I'm going to lose 16% on that part of my portfolio.
It's right.
Not a surprise. It's not unexpected at all. So I think I've gotten really comfortable with just pick the asset allocation. And if you do index funds, you're just going to get the market returns. I'm good with that. I don't know that in advance I could pick the active manager that's going to beat the market. I can in hindsight, but I certainly can in advance.
Right. Yes.
So when I say an FA or a, you know, maybe a CFP and FA, I don't think you need for investment management. I don't mean that to imply they don't add value. I think there's huge areas they add value. I think just overall having a retirement plan and, you know, what percent should you be saving toward, what goal you're trying to hit, safe withdrawal rates, decumulation. I mean, I have to say, getting at this point in my life, to me, the accumulation phase was way easier than the decumulation phase. And I think advisors can be super helpful there. The analysis of Roth conversions, reviewing your insurance, are you overinsured or underinsured? Like after I got divorced, other than what I had to keep from the settlement, I dropped all the life insurance. I had enough money to cover my kids' education. They weren't relying on me anymore. Why should I be paying all this money in insurance? I also think the planners have much better software tools. I mean, some of the Monte Carlo analysis, the cash flow projections. I mean, if you're really good, you can go build that in Excel, but there's a whole lot of variables and stuff that goes into those models. But I think unless maybe you were a super programmer, that's going to be tough to do.
Yeah.
I've also found just getting a second opinion. So being a do-it-yourself or just the CFP giving me a second opinion, you know, I think you're doing okay. I think, you know, maybe you're a little too aggressive. It's good. You have somebody to bounce stuff off. There's a saying in the legal field that a lawyer that represents himself or herself has a fool for a client. And I've kind of thought that as a do-it-yourself, you know, maybe at some point that being a CFP myself, do I have a fool for a client if I'm only relying on myself?
Right.
I think it's kind of good advice. The last thing I would say about using a planner for me is the Monte Carlo analysis was really hard for me to wrap my head around. I think the best way to explain it, I didn't know what it was telling me that was actionable or would change anything I needed to do. So I came back with like an 82% success rate or something. And I think the CFP I worked with said they like it to be 70 or above. So I'm like, okay, well, is 70, I take it 78 is good then. And then as I understand, it's very binary. If you fail by a dollar, then you fail in that scenario. And so that to me doesn't have a lot of practical implications. So I'm not saying it's bad. I just think CFPs maybe need to explain it a little better so their client understands what it is and isn't telling them. What's your take?
I agree. I've done, I definitely did a video about it. I did a podcast episode about it. Same thing. What it is, what it isn't, how to use it, what its drawbacks are. It is basically, it tries to be a crystal ball. It's going to be wrong. It is trying to use past data and measures of things that are statistically possible to say, this is what your portfolio is. Here's your anticipated expenses. Here's your other sources of income, if any, like Social Security, et cetera. Let's run your portfolio through 1,000 different trials of potential outcomes, where the range of potential outcomes is, again, based on how your portfolio has performed in the past and what sort of are statistically relevant movements up and down along the way throughout the rest of your 30 years or whatever time frame you're looking at. And so then it'll show, out of these 1,000 different scenarios of statistically possible outcomes, doesn't mean there can't be outliers beyond that, but it's like, you know, a band of what's reasonably possible to happen. And how many of those 1,000 do you not deplete your investable portfolio by the time you die? To your point, whether you end up with $1 projected at your death or $10 million projected at your death, those are a quote unquote success, just the same in Monte Carlo speak. So in your case, I think you said it was 82%. So 820 of the 1,000 trials that this person ran for you, you ended up with at least a dollar. Could be one, could be 10 million, but at least a dollar. In those other 18 trials, you would have depleted your investable assets by the time you were 95 or whatever your assumed date of death was. Now, that doesn't mean there's an 18% chance you die broke. Monte Carlo is a point in time snapshot, projecting out 30 years or whatever, assuming your expenses are going to be whatever is assumed, assuming your Social Security is going to be whatever it is, et cetera. In reality, what's going to happen is along the way, things are going to change. Market's going to do good, do bad, whatever. Your inflation is going to be higher or lower. You know, your longevity is going to, your health might change. And so the way I use Monte Carlo is we run it today. And I agree, if it's over 80, that's good. Over 90 is fantastic. Over 70, below 70 is where it's like, yeah, we probably shouldn't assume this plan's going to work. So for example, yours is 82. Run it today. Fast forward a year. There's one less year of life. There's one less year of market variability. We have a closer data point of what your actual Social Security is, et cetera. We run it again. Maybe let's say it's 83. Okay, good. Let's keep going. Run it the next year. Maybe it drops to 80 because the market tanks. Run it the next year. Maybe it drops to 75 because you had to increase expenses a lot because inflation, or you're just going nuts having parties. That's a signal to rein it in. We look for trends in the Monte Carlo along the way. If the success outcome keeps trending downward, something's got to give. You got to spend less. You got to invest differently. Probably spend less, frankly, is the more impactful one. Or, you know, go back to part-time work or something. That's what it's useful for. There's so many variables between your longevity, market returns, inflation, tax legislation, that it's impossible to map this out with certainty. Monte Carlo is the best and closest thing we have to a crystal ball that tries to make reasonable estimates about these things. That's probably the best I could explain it in, you know, the course of 2 minutes. So hopefully that was helpful.
No, that's a great explanation. That helps a lot. Put it in the right perspective of what it is and isn't telling you.
Yeah, it's sort of a feasibility check. If your result came back at 40%, that means no, we shouldn't assume this is going to work. Work longer, spend less, invest differently, whatever. Again, if it comes back 70 or above, like, yeah, this is a good starting case. If it comes back 90 or above, it's like, yeah, you got a pretty wide amount of discretion in how this can play out. So if it's 100, that's excessively good. I mean, unless you're trying to really die with a lot of money, 100 is almost overkill, almost certainly overkill for everyone. And I also, just side note, I don't like that Monte Carlo software even allows 100. I feel like that's misleading because that implies like nothing could possibly go wrong.
Right.
100% okay. I wish they'd cap out at 99. Even if statistically it did show 100, I wish they'd stop at 99 because it's sort of like a false sense of security almost.
Sure.
But anyway, okay. Good. No, I agree with all your comments about advisors. I won't make this a rant about whether people should or shouldn't hire advisors. I think many people don't need them. Or if they do decide to use them, like to your point, just get a status check, get some hourly work, whatever. I will be the first one to say not everyone wants or needs the full kit and caboodle of an ongoing advisor where they're charging however much money per year, be it flat fee, be it percent of assets. Some people, sure, they'll see a lot of value and really appreciate it. Other people just won't, for whatever the reasons are, and that's the right answer for them. So yep. Don't let someone push their services on you in that case. Okay. Where are we? No, next question doesn't apply. Okay, so some more technical aspects about your retirement. So may or may not apply to you. I know you're not 65 yet, but if you do stop working prior to 65, what do you plan on doing for healthcare since you won't yet be Medicare eligible?
Yeah, I've been self-employed for a number of years, so I've been getting my own policies either through the major carriers or on the Obamacare exchanges. So that would just be a continuation of that. I feel like I'm pretty experienced in that area as well. So that wouldn't be a change. I think it's tougher for people coming off the corporate world trying to decide between COBRA and, I mean, plans on these exchanges are expensive if you don't get subsidies. So I would probably try to get subsidies going forward, just live off cash to make up for it. The other nice thing being self-employed, I get to write off the health insurance premiums that I do pay. So that is a great benefit.
Right. Self-employed health insurance deduction is nice. And even Medicare premiums are eligible as well if you are still working beyond 65.
Yes.
Those premiums are deductible for, against self-employment income. Okay. Social Security. We sort of touched on this before, but what's your thoughts now on claiming Social Security for yourself?
You know, it's such a complex question. I don't know that I have a good answer to it. I've been debating if being single makes it easier or harder. I only say that because I think if you're married, maybe having the higher earner defer to 70. So if they predecease the spouse gets a higher benefit, that's maybe not the right answer in all cases, but that seems more compelling. As a single guy, I'm like, man, I don't really know here. So, telling you something you already know, but it seems like the most important piece of information you need to make the decision you never have, which is when you're going to die. So that makes it a little tougher as well. My thought at this point is if I retire early, I would probably just live off my portfolio. And I only have a portfolio. I don't have any pension or anything. I don't have any annuities. If the sequence of return risks are bad, then I could claim early to stop depleting the portfolio so much. If the market does okay, I'm comfortable, just continuing to live off the portfolio, then I would probably delay till full retirement age or even age 70. I've heard some people say if you don't really need the money, take it early. But there are certain tax implications as well. And if you're trying to get subsidies or other, even just the taxability of Social Security itself and all. So it's pretty difficult decision, I think, but that's my current thinking, kind of play it by ear and see how things are going and pull the trigger. One hand, it's nice to have that flexibility, sort of a cushion against portfolio, depletion too early. But man, I wish it were easier. I really do.
I think you're thinking about it the right way. You have the angles in mind that need to be considered. I think one day you're going to wake up and you'll just know it, whatever the combination of reasons is, you're going to know when it's right for you. This is an incredibly difficult question, seemingly simple on the surface. Like everyone logically asks, when should I start Social Security? But that ties into so many other aspects of your life. Like you said, tax planning, ability to get ACA subsidies, portfolio investment returns, longevity. It's not something that can be answered in isolation. It is an incredibly difficult question. And the right answer today could change over time. Like you said, if your portfolio does really poorly, the answer may change and you speed up starting Social Security.
Yep.
So it's good for people to be aware of the things to consider, but don't feel like you're failing if you haven't nailed down a rock solid, 100% confident answer. Because that probably doesn't exist for most folks.
And I would say if you are married, just make sure you really understand the rules. I was having this debate with a relative this week and some things his advisor told him, and then I was looking at it and it's really complicated. I mean, if your spouse takes early and then later gets your subsidy, Well, my understanding is your spouse doesn't end up with half of what your FRA benefit would be. It is a reduction because they started early. It's just complicated stuff. And I think you could easily make the wrong decision because you misunderstood how a provision applies or how a benefit is calculated.
Yeah. Another book I read last month was something along the lines of Social Security Horror Stories. And it was written by Larry Kotlikoff and Terry Savage. So Larry wrote a book called Get What's Yours. It came out 2015, maybe, all about Social Security, written in really plain English, explained the system well, explained good planning opportunities. And as a result, I can't prove this, but I'm fairly confident this is right. As a result of one of the strategies he pointed out in the book, Social Security legislation changed to take it away. It was what's called file and suspend. I attribute that to Larry's book and him making it so publicly known. And so he wrote the second book now, Social Security Horror Stories, which is all about that, how complicated the system is, how much people don't know, the fact that Social Security doesn't need to and often doesn't take it upon themselves to tell people, hey, you could or should do this differently because there's other benefits available to you. Really scary stuff. I'm not trying to frighten people. I mean, I think the system as a whole is good. It does a lot of good for a lot of people. It's not fair. A lot of people get skunked. Other people get overly generous benefits, but it is what it is. But understanding the rules is paramount. So there's lots of places you can go for that. Terry's book, Larry Kotlikoff's first book is probably a great start if anyone's interested. I'll share a link to that. But it is a beast of a system, unfortunately.
And do you think, Andy, from your experience, most financial advisors understand the calculations and the rules? Or are you better off finding somebody that really specializes in Social Security strategies?
This goes back to your prior comment about the difference between accumulation and decumulation stages of life. I don't like correlating advisors to doctors, but there are some times where I think the analogies fit. Think about doctors. You go to a general practitioner doctor, he or she isn't going to be able to do surgery on your heart, or they're not going to be able to repair an intricate, tendon issue on your ankle. They're specialists. Advisors are similar in that regard. They're not all created equally, even though I think most people generally think they are, unfortunately. So where I'm going with this is advisors and the vast majority of the world of financial advisors really just focus on accumulation. They're investment focused. They want to gather your assets, charge you, 1% on them. And in my opinion, overcomplicate the investment management process of your portfolio. They may throw in some light financial planning on their periphery, but they're really investment focused. Those folks probably aren't going to understand Social Security much, if at all, because it's not what they do. They're just helping people get and accumulate and keep money. It is very different. The knowledge, the mindset, the how you approach investing a portfolio and taking money out of portfolios is its own separate thing and skill set and focus when you're decumulating, when you're retired versus accumulating. So to answer your question, I think folks who intentionally focus on decumulation planning, like my firm, I specifically won't work with anyone who's under 55 or at least not on the cusp of retiring because all we do is decumulation retirement focused. I don't touch people that need to save for college or save for their first house. I'm not saying that's not important. It's just not what I choose to specialize in. Yeah. So truly retirement-focused planners should know Social Security really well. And if they get asked a question they don't know, they will know how to find the answer for you. But just pick a random advisor, someone who calls them an advisor, pick a random one of those off the street, they're not going to know these rules nearly well enough to help someone make an informed decision. Which comes back to your point, why I want to see you write this book. How is the average person supposed to know this? They think an advisor is an advisor. They're not, right? And so it needs to be some framework to helping people source, vet, decide amongst due diligence on advisors to find out who's the right fit for them, not who's convenient or not who is referred from their friend or not who's nearby in town. Those are not ways to make decisions about hiring an advisor. Sorry, long-winded answer, but.
No, I appreciate that. One of the things I've thought about is I get closer to retirement, what I'm going to do in retirement. I thought about just, I don't know if pro bono is the right word here, but just helping people for no cost. Because I want to give back. I like doing this. Help them get ready to interview financial advisors and evaluate advisors. I don't know if there'd be an interest in that, but I would enjoy that kind of work, and it would help people, you know, make sure they're picking somebody who really does meet their needs versus, as you say, just one of these run-of-the-mill people out there saying they're an advisor.
I think that's great. I think if you get the word out properly, you're going to get really consumed really quick. If you do this for free, I think you should charge, you know, even if it's a nominal fee, charge something. But I think that's a tremendous idea that a lot of people take you up on if you do pursue that, like the book, hint, hint.
Okay. You give me a lot of homework.
I just blocked off the next 2 years of your life, right? Yes. So you're welcome. All right. Roth conversions. Do you do them? If so, what's your strategy and process around that for yourself?
I have not done them. The CFP I used a couple of years ago came back and said, based on my tax bracket and all, it didn't really make sense at this point. So I'll definitely take a look at it again if I retire early, or even if I retire later and delay Social Security. It's another area I found tough to really wrap my head around the math. And it also has a lot of variables. I feel like right now the sort of flavor du jour is convert, no matter what, convert. If you're not converting, you're an idiot. I don't know. I'm not sure about that. It seemed to me, and this may not be right, I've not put enough time into it, but it would seem to me the future return of the market has a huge impact on the value of the conversion, because then you get all of that gain, not tax, if the market does really well. But you're losing the taxes you have to pay on the conversion, the time value of money on that and all. So it's something I need to study further. But if I get in a low enough tax bracket, I think it would probably make sense to do it. And I know when I hit, I think I'm up to 75 now before my RMDs start, but that's going to be a decent number,
right?
And even a bigger number in, you know, 15 years from now, if the market does okay.
My view is Roth conversions are one of these optimization, as is most tax planning. It's one of these optimization things. If you don't do it, it's not going to make or break your plan. It's not one of the big boulders to get right, which is your overall allocation, which is, you know, your income relative, your expenses, things like that. Whether or not you convert, it can make a good plan a little better. It can make a bad plan a little better, but it's not going to take someone from this plan flat out doesn't work to all of a sudden I do conversions and like magic now, you know, everything's gold. That's not it. It's more of an optimization thing. So I agree with you. I think it's sort of the word du jour, partly the industry's fault for harping so much on it. I do think objectively, it's a good time now, all else equal, just because we know federal tax rates are slated to go up in a couple years, barring any changes before then. So that alone means all else equal, you know, it's better now than it is 2 years from now. But that by itself shouldn't tell people, yeah, do conversions, because there's so much more to it. All right. Home. Do you own a home?
I do not. I sold my house in 2022. I downsized, moved from Chicago suburbs to Florida, and moved into an apartment. So I'm currently renting, which is a weird experience after all these years. Longer term, I think I'd like to own a house again. But I have to say, being in an apartment's been nice. I mean, I live right in the city. I can walk to everything. No surprise expenses. If something breaks, I go online, fill out a form versus 8 or 10 trips to Home Depot where you realize that part comes in 17 different sizes. But I think longer term, I'd like to, I don't know. There is something nice about having a house that's yours. You have some pride of ownership in it. Sure. I'm kind of handy, so I also just like tinkering around the house and being able to fix stuff. One day the light switch wasn't working and the maintenance guys who were great came to fix it, but they were having trouble. I was just holding myself back so much. Can I just go do that? I'll show you how that three-way works. But so that was my thought. If I do get a house, I'd like to finance. I've heard it can be tough to finance if you are retired. So if I have to pay cash, I would probably pay cash and then look at reverse mortgages. I know reverse mortgages have a really bad rep, but I've been reading some of Wade Fowle's work in that area, a few others, and he has some really interesting points. And I think reverse mortgages can certainly help with liquidity and housing issues in retirement. So I would encourage everybody to look at them. I'm not here to say they're right for you or wrong, but I wouldn't dismiss them out of hand, especially if you are a little bit liquidity challenged.
Yeah, there's something to be said for them. They could make a lot of sense in some situations. They're not the four-letter word or, you know, dirty word that they got the reputation for 15 years ago when the market and the lenders were more unscrupulous and less forthcoming about the product. The government then stepped in and sort of cleaned it up, put a lot more restriction and process around it to make sure people really know what they're getting into. And there's less jokers out there in the industry now. Most loans are backed by the government and need to fit certain criteria and rules. So there's the industry has cleaned itself up a lot since the horror stories people probably heard from 15 or so years ago. And renting is, just side note, I think there's a lot to be said for renting as well. Like you said, you don't have the ownership and ability to could paint the walls, whatever you want and stuff like that. But from pure dollars and cents, it's not necessarily a bad idea, especially now with houses being so historically expensive and who knows if and when they'll come back down in price. Plus you have the flexibility of, you know, you want out in a year, go ahead. You just walk away, you know, stop, well, assuming your lease is over. Things break, you don't have headaches to worry about. So that's, especially for folks that aren't committed to a forever home, if you're still trying things out, different parts of the country or different stages of life, like I think there's nothing wrong with renting, honestly.
And that was part of it for me. I knew I wanted out of Illinois because of the taxes and some other issues, but I didn't really know where I wanted to be. So I didn't want to, at that time, put the money into a house. I would say though, in my case, so I live in St. Petersburg, Florida, so it's probably one of the more expensive cities in Florida, but my rent is about the same as my mortgage and property taxes were in Illinois. Now, I don't have all the landscape and, you know, upkeep and other expenses, but it wasn't as cheap. Now, I could move out in the suburbs and probably find a place for a lot cheaper than here, but it wasn't quite the cost savings I had expected on the pure rent and all. But and my mortgage was like 3.25, so that, you know, now it would probably be a lot cheaper than the 6 or 7% mortgage rate. But kind of a drawback sometimes. Nicest places you want to live are expensive, right?
Yeah.
Just goes with it.
Okay. This next question, I realize I should break up into multiple questions. There's a lot, but let's start with just investment allocations. If you're willing and able to share, how do you approach your investments?
Yeah, right now I'm about 70-30. The 30 would include cash. So 70% equities, 30% a combination of bond index funds in cash. The CFP I saw recommended I go to 60-40. That was one piece of her advice that I think was solid. I just have always been a little more on the equity side. So I've stayed at 70-30. It's probably above that now with what the market's done the last 3 months. But going into retirement, I'll probably be somewhere between 60-40, 70-30. I don't really see myself going below 60. I'll probably do a bucket strategy, just have a couple of years living expenses and more liquid, either short-term bond funds, tax-exempt bond funds, pending, or money market funds. I guess money market's paying 5 or 5+%.
They're really good now. Yeah. Historically, you know, 3 years ago, they were paying point oh nothing, but now.
Right. So that's been a nice bump there. And then in terms of kind of distribution strategies in retirement, I'm sorry, I keep saying this is hard. This is complicated.
Well, it is. That's why.
It is. Yeah. And I also think if you want to leave money to your heirs, you know, historically the advice was spend down your taxable brokerage accounts first and save your 401ks and everything else till later. You know, with this 10-year requirement for inherited IRA to get distributed now, I don't know. And then the whole tax brackets of where I am and where my heirs might be might make that whole which accounts to attack first or draw from first very different. So I need to spend a little more time on that one as well.
Exactly. A simple, basic example is if you know you're going to leave money to your kids, let's assume you know you're going to have $1 million left over and it's currently in an IRA. So it's all, you know, hasn't yet been taxed. And let's just assume you're in the 22% federal tax bracket and your kids, let's assume they're high earners, doctors, lawyers, whatever, they're in the 30-something% tax bracket and likely always will be. So now if you die and leave them the $1 million, you know they're paying 30+% versus if you convert it now or distribute it and turn around and like flip it into a bank account for them to eventually get, you're only paying whatever, 22%. Yep. So from a wealth transfer perspective, as much as it may sting to have to pay 22% tax now, if you know it's going to your kids and they're going to pay more, you can increase the amount of net of tax money you ultimately leave them by sort of doing this, you know, wealth transfer tax arbitrage thing. But to your point, it makes it hard in figuring it all
out. Yeah. And you also have to step up in basis, right? If you're putting a taxable brokerage account, it's almost tax-free to your heirs with the step up in basis versus you've had in an IRA or qualified retirement plan.
Right.
Yeah.
It's another one of these optimization things without the benefit of knowing exactly how the future is going to play out for you, for them, for tax legislation, et cetera. You can't know for certain what the best outcome is going to be.
Right. Right.
All right. And I just had a comment about asset allocation. So you mentioned you're 70-30. The person you met with recommended 60-40. My view is those two are practically the same. And it's another one of those optimization things. Whether you're 70-30, 65-35, 60-40, they're close enough. I wouldn't sweat getting that dialed in, right? That's very different from being 100-0 or like 30-70. Yeah. Those will really impact your future outcome. But give or take 10 percentage points, like it's kind of, you're playing on the margins. You don't know which one's ultimately going to be better, but they're both close enough. Okay. Next set here, let's see how many of these apply. These are my set of questions for people who are already retired. You sort of aren't, sort of are.
Can I just answer the first one?
Yeah, please. Whatever you think is relative to you. Go ahead. You have the list in front of you.
I mean, the question asks about the emotional transition. So yeah, I'm not there yet, but I think as I'm thinking about retirement, I'm sort of there. And I think it's going to be hard. I've always saved a lot. I've always had a portfolio that grows. Now, I don't mean to say it won't grow in retirement. Hopefully it does. But it's a whole shift in the mindset. And I would also say the fear is real. I think fear is a very powerful emotion. So you've always been earning a paycheck. Later years, you've been earning a nice paycheck, you know, that's going to stop. So that's one sort of strike. And then you're going to be withdrawing the money from what you save. So that's the other strike. And not bad. I mean, ideally, you've planned for all this. This is what you knew was going to happen. But I think it's going to be hard for me. I think there's stuff I'm going to be afraid about. I was talking with my retired relative this week. He's been retired 6 years now. I think he retired at 57. And for the first time over those 6 years, I felt like he was finally comfortable with where he was at, how it was going. He's done very well. So in my mind, he shared some of his stuff. I'm like, yeah, nothing to ever worry about. But for him too, the fear's real and the wonder and the what ifs. So I'm going to be interested to see how I handle this. But I think psychologically, it's a tough transition.
I think if you find it seamless and a non-issue, there's something almost not human about you. Like, I think most people should, I'm not saying it's good necessarily, but they should have some reluctance or hesitation or emotional difficulty going from accumulating and saving to now decumulating and spending. That's gotta be hard. And I mean, I know it is. I've seen it play out firsthand. For what it's worth, if you do have a good plan in place, the first year or two of retirement, you probably have some discomfort around this change. And then eventually you're like, okay, we're good. That discomfort passes for most people. And then, like, okay, let me spend more. Sometimes you have to rein people in a little bit, but all right.
Well, that was the one other thing I had is I thought about this question, Andy. There's such little literature information about the upside risk of retirement, right? So, I mean, look what the market's done since, what was it, November, late October. I mean, I don't think anybody's expecting this, but nobody really plans for what if my portfolio is 25% higher than I'd projected. What am I going to do? Does it change anything? Am I just happy I have more money? Do I spend more? Do I do that 90-day world cruise? Yep. Do I leave more to my heirs? Do I gift it now? But I would love to see more information on that because I feel like a lot of the planning is the downside, the doomsday. What if you have bad sequence return risks, et cetera? But, what if it's all very positive? And for a lot of people, it probably has been.
Yeah. I think anecdotally, yes, I'd agree with that. Not to say there aren't people who run out of money for whatever reason it may be, but many people end up doing much better than they were concerned they were going to, especially over the last 10 years. There's been some ugly years in there, 2022, but I know someone who retired relatively early, 5-6 years ago, and his portfolio now is noticeably higher than it was then. And he's been living off of it for these 5 or 6 years. Now, who knows if that's going to persist going forward, but it's hard. Again, the goal is like die with zero for most people, but you can't hit that with accuracy. I think it is a failure in a sense to die with too much money because that represents life unlived. But it's more dangerous of a failure to run out prematurely. So that's my guess why the industry and media focuses more on how to not run out as opposed to how to not end with too much.
But that makes sense. Yeah.
There's solutions to help try to take some of the uncertainty out. And this isn't a pitch for insurance products, but like annuities, there's lots of different flavors of annuities. I'm not painting with the same brush saying they're all good or bad. But at one extreme, if you want to take all variability off the table of how much asset you're going to die with or what your income is going to be, you can take every single dollar you have and buy annuities with it, where you now have $0 to your name. I mean, there's other ways you can still have access to the money, but let's make a super extreme example. You now have $0 to your name, so you're guaranteed to die with zero. In its place, you have an IOU from the insurance company where you're going to get, I'm just making this number up, you know, $10,000 a month every year for the rest of your life. So your income's always going to be there. Whether you die tomorrow or die in 40 years, you're getting $10,000 a month for life. And when you die, you will have zero because you gave all that money to the insurance company. There's still risk in that because that $10,000 is going to be fixed. So there's still inflation risk, right? Like what if your expenses are here? So that's not a foolproof solution, but you know, some mix of the two, you can better refine, guarantee myself some more income for, you know, giving up some of the potential upside, where a lot of people, they don't care about the upside. They, you know, they just want to not run out, in which case this can be a good solution. But again, I'm not pitching it. I know a lot of people are steadfastly opposed to it, you know, for right or for wrong, but it is an option that can help take some of the variability out of. Otherwise, if you're a pure, you know, market stock and bond portfolio, there is going to be a lot of who knows about the future. All right. Any other of the retired questions that are applicable to you, Tom?
No, I don't think they are. Okay. Maybe get together again in a couple of years and go through them.
Yeah, cool. And final question, curious to see where you go with this. If you can give one piece of advice or guidance to others about retirement planning, what would it be?
So I have to admit in advance, I cheated on this one because we didn't cover a lot of those retirement questions. So bear with me. I'll make it fairly quick, though. But my one piece of advice would be to follow these five pieces of advice that I'm going to outline here. So one was don't neglect the non-financial aspects of retirement. So we've talked a lot about that during our time here today. I would probably summarize that a lot of people listening to this podcast are going to be just fine financially in retirement. I think the non-financial aspects may be a lot harder for them. And I would just encourage people to put the right amount of time into figuring that out as well. Second one, this might sound a little esoteric, but I really would encourage people to understand their relationship to money or with money and what it means to them. We have this lifelong relationship. I mean, money is a big part of all of our lives. And I think a lot of people struggle with what is it? What does it mean to them? In my own case, I'm not a super material person. So I don't need a lot of possessions and things to make me happy, maybe other than kitchen and woodworking tools. But to me, it always meant freedom. So if I got laid off from a job and I had a balance that could, you know, get me through 8, 10, 12 months, then some of the pressure was off. I didn't have to take the first thing that came along. As I get closer to retirement, have done pretty well. You know, I have the freedom to travel. It's a big goal of mine in retirement and all. So for other people, it means, you know, ability to have really nice things, et cetera. But I just think if you don't understand what you want the money for, it can create some issues. And I think understanding can help you focus and know why you're doing what you're doing. The third one would be save and invest regularly. We've talked about that. And going along with that, I just say stay invested. I'm sure you and a lot of listeners have seen those studies that if you're not in the market the best 5 or 10 days of the year, your average return over those time periods is so much less, and you can't predict when it's going to go up or down. So I would just encourage people to stay in if you're saving and investing regularly. The fourth one would be don't neglect your earnings power during the accumulation phase. I think it's a great asset, sometimes an underappreciated asset, but and I'm not saying make a lot of money at the expense of your rest of your life. I certainly got burned out working 60 hours a week and wasn't healthy, but there's got to be a balance in there. And if you do have opportunities to improve your earnings and what you're making, that can give you a lot more opportunity to save, give you more flexibility. And then lastly, I just say have some financial goals, ideally ones you have control over. And what I mean by that is, hey, I want $1 million by age 50. I mean, that's probably a good goal, but you might not be able to control it. If we have a period of bad market returns, but you can control it. I want to max my 401k contribution each year. I want to max my employer match. I want to fully fund my HSA. I want to put $300 a month in a taxable brokerage account. Whatever those goals are, I think they're helpful because they can help you turn out the noise. So I'm not sure your goal should be, did I beat the market in my investment portfolio this year? I mean, that's kind of a random thing. Nice to beat the market, I guess. But I think other goals that you really have an influence over, I think, can help you stay on the path, not get as discouraged if there's a couple down years. So sorry to cheat there, Andy, but just wanted to put those out there.
No, that was great. I think those are very helpful for everyone listening. And I wholeheartedly agree to everything you just said with those. So thank you. All right. Well, this was very fascinating. Learned a lot. I think you have really good insight. It was interesting that you have the CFP non-practicing, but you know, it shows you have a little more sort of technical, formal, educational background in this stuff, which was cool to hear you translate how that applies and, you know, has applied to your life. So thank you for sharing. Hope you all listened. Thank you. Found it super helpful, and I appreciate you being on. Thank you, Tom.
Thanks, Andy. Take care.
Well, that's it. I hope you enjoyed my chat with Tom. I thought that was really interesting. It's cool to see someone who has the CFP, but is just a normal person, for lack of a better word. I think it, I'm not saying everyone should go out and get it, but it's an interesting angle that I haven't come across someone yet who wasn't in the industry, who wasn't a practicing advisor of some sort yet has the CFP. So that was cool. I hope you all found that interesting. We've got another great guest next month lined up. I hope you are digging these real person episodes. I'm trying to get a mix of different people with different backgrounds, experiences, life situations, etc. So bear with me. You know, over time, I commit to you, there will be a wide array of people and diversity and scenarios and you know, financial situations, life situations, what have you. So hope you're looking forward to that. I know I am. As always, if you like this podcast, help your boy out. I would greatly appreciate some positive feedback on Apple iTunes or iPods or whatever it's called. Any other platform, podcast listening platform you may use to listen to this, you know, and any sort of likes, thumbs up, reviews would be greatly appreciated. As for the other sources, if you haven't already, check out Retirement Planning Education, which is sort of the single spot that gathers together all of my various content sources, which are the Facebook group, Retirement Planning Education, the YouTube channel, Retirement Planning Education, this podcast, and then my company's newsletter, Retirement Planning Insights. You can find links to those in the notes to this episode. That's it. Thank you as always. I will see you next time.
The information discussed in this podcast is only general explanations and education. It is not specific tax, legal, or investment advice. Before considering acting on anything you heard here, first consult with your tax, legal, or investment advisor. Thank you.